So the last paragraph that we did, just to remind us of some of the themes, the use of the words vagaries and detective is here precise and significant. That's McLuhan commenting on a statement said in James Joyce's novel Stephen Hero, which was the precursor to the Portrait of the Artist, the first version of the Portrait of the Artist as a young man. So the use of the words vagaries and detective is here precise and significant. Well, maybe I should read the part from Stephen Hero. If you were an aesthetic philosopher, you would take note of all my vagaries, because here you have the spectacle of the aesthetic instinct in action. The philosophic college should spare a detective for me. So the update would be the Trump administration should spare a bodyguard for Carolyn, or someone who goes around and interviews Carolyn, take down what she has to say. But back then, it's the philosophic college should spare a detective for me, says Stephen Hero. He's feeling quite powerful. So then McLuhan says, the use of the words vagaries and detective is here precise and significant. For on the one hand, the figure of the labyrinth is used everywhere by Joyce as the archetype of cognition and aesthetic apprehension, the symbol, the archetype of the drama of cognition. And on the other hand, the modern detective, since Edgar Allan Poe, employs the technique of retracing in order to reconstruct an action exactly as it occurred. Edgar Allan Poe is rightly regarded in France as the father of symbolism because he was the first to formulate the poetic process as one of discovering by retracing, or metanoia. I add metanoia. The precise poetic formula for any emotion, or an effect, Edgar Allan Poe pointed out, was to be found by working backwards from effect to the arrangement of words which would produce that effect. It is also his aesthete, character in his detective books, Dupin, D-U-P-I-N. It is also his aesthete Dupin who first displays the same method in the service of crime detection. The modern psychologist, historiographer, and archaeologist use this method in common with the physicist, the chemist, and the private eye. Professor Gilson's Unity, his book titled Unity, A Philosophic Experience, has the distinction of being the first work of philosophy in which this method of reconstruction, metanoia, is fully employed. But it's materialistic metanoia. You're using the cultural artifacts as part of the signpost. Now, I want to point out here that the drama of cognition, the stages of apprehension, these phrases that he was using in the early 50s, become in the 60s or late 50s, once he's studying media of communication, they become the action of the senses. So the sensory interplay that McLuhan is famous for in the 60s, the fact that media are extension of our senses, and that was like a new idea for people, to see media as an extension of our senses. The senses was his replaceable term, or the replacing term for the drama of cognition, because the interaction of your senses, what the medieval people called your sensus communis, is the stages of apprehension you engage in every moment. So the dynamic symmetry of proportions among tensions, or tensions among proportions, that interplay of your senses is the drama of cognition. So nobody has linked the terminology of McLuhan's 60s work back to his 50s criticism, art criticism, of these two terms. But it's he's talking about the same process. Different words in different decades. So we come to this new paragraph, and it says, but a great deal, so he's ended up by telling the psychologist, historiographer, archaeologist, physicist, chemist, and the private eye, you all are working with the same method, which was started by Edgar Allan Poe and completed by James Joyce. That would be news to them. So he says, but a great deal of poetic experiment and development preceded the discovery of the technique of reconstruction as discovery. So he's going to go back before Edgar Allan Poe and talk about what happened in the 1700s, the 18th century, that led up to Poe and then Baudelaire, Mallarmé, and the Symbolists. So McLuhan said elsewhere in the 60s that what was discovered in the 19th century was the technique of discovery, how you would invent something. You'd work backwards. And so aesthetically, in the poetic process, you work backwards. But the science started to figure that out in laboratory experiments. So they discovered the technique of discovery in the 19th century. So what did they discover in the 20th century? The technique of the suspended judgment. That's a kind of 418 group tetrad management, a level of detachment. The bankers, the intelligence agencies were monitoring the global processes with a suspending judgment. Okay? The technique of the suspended judgment was a big discovery of the 20th century. Okay, but we're going to go back to the discovery of the technique of discovery. So he says, but a great deal of poetic experiment and development preceded the discovery of what? The discovery of the technique of reconstruction as discovery. The discovery of the technique of reconstruction as discovery. So they developed the technique of discovery, which was the technique of reconstruction, retracing, starting with the effect and figuring out what would cause the effect. And most of all, or what would line up with the effect. So then McLuhan says, and most of all is owing to the practitioners of the picturesque school of landscape that began with James Thompson in 1724. By the time of Walter Scott, Lord Byron, and Chateaubriand, the possibilities of discontinuous landscape, or the picturesque school of landscape, the possibilities of discontinuous landscape as a means of including and controlling a vast range of otherwise chaotic material was available to the novelist as a means of examining, quote, the entire community in action. That's what Stephen Hero says just before he says the Philosophic College is spare detective for me. He says, the modern method examines its territory by the light of day. It examines the entire community in action and reconstructs the spectacle of redemption. So then, so let me read that again. By the time of, so, and most of all, and most of all of the technique of poetic experiment and figuring out the technique of discovery, and most of all is owing to the practitioners of the picturesque school of landscape that began with James Thompson in 1724. By the time of Walter Scott, Lord Byron, and Chateaubriand, the possibilities of discontinuous landscape. Now that was, discontinuity was the breaking up of the hypnosis of linearity and smooth prose that science and literature had gotten into after the Gutenberg press. If you read some of the literature just before the printing press takes off, before Newton's effect takes off, like someone like Thomas Nash that McLuhan did his PhD on, they write multi-leveled semi-Finneganese. It's very oral and gesticulating and discontinuous. But it gets smoothed over in the 1600s and 1700s until the poets going out onto the natural landscapes, because they were driven out of the ugly cities, and started looking around at the discontinuity in nature, that they developed an aesthetic value of the discontinuous. So by the time of Scott, Byron, and Chateaubriand, the possibilities of now ultimate android mimic discontinuity is this video we played called Panda. Right? That's quantum levels of discontinuity. You get half a syllable out, you know? So the discontinuity gets exaggerated by every new medium, electric medium, and every new art movement that rises with every new technology. For example, the Impressionists, and then the Fauvists, and then the Expressionists, and then the Dadaists, and then the Surrealists, and then the Constructivists, the ones who turn machine work, the Russians who turn machine city planning, machinic environments into art form, Fernand Léger. And then Lewis comes along, and I call him the vorticists. Lewis, Joyce, and Pound start to notice the vortex of technological whirlpool, we could say. They started to notice the structures of media around them. That was, so the vortices come after the expressionists, dadaists, and surrealists, and constructivists. And the reason Wyndham Lewis was the leading thinker in 1913, 1914, when he meets Ezra Pound and inspires Pound and Yeats, and then eventually Joyce, is that he had traveled through Europe in the 1900s, 1904, 5, 6, 7, 8, and encountered all these radical art forms, like the constructivists and the expressionists and the Dadaists and all that. Whatever was happening in the 1900s, the 1900 naughty knots, he was the only guy in England out there he got out of art school and took off and spent 10 years wandering around Europe learning. So he came back, you know, the most informed guy in 19, I think he comes back in 1908, 1909, and he starts writing for Ford Maddox, Ford's Journal, and that was the leading journal at that point. Pound was part of it, and then it took off until he created the Vorticist movement. So now McLuhan, with 2020 vision, is looking back at this whole process. So by the time of Walter Scott, Lord Byron, and Chateaubriand, the possibilities of discontinuous landscape as a means of including and controlling a vast range of otherwise chaotic material, so information overload in the printing press, was available to the novelist as a means of examining the entire community in action. And that's in quotes, the entire community in action. First Stendhal, S-T-E-N-D-H-A-L, and then Flaubert and Dickens went ahead on these lines. But Flaubert was the first to see in his book called Sentimental Education that it means the abandonment of the continuity of unilateral narrative, or you could say univocal, in favor of the more profound effects to be achieved by analogical juxtaposition of characters, scenes, and situations without copula, without connection. Starting to make a collage, a mosaic. So I'll read that again. Flaubert was the first to see in his book, Sentimental Education, that it means that this extended discontinuity, it means the abandonment of the continuity of unilateral narrative in favor of the more profound effects to be achieved by analogical juxtaposition of characters, scenes, and situations without copula. So that the Cartesian cries against Cubist discontinuity. So the old 19th century art science establishment that objects to Picasso and Einstein, they're holding on to the linear effect of the Gutenberg. So McLuhan calls them Cartesian, you know, derived from Descartes. So that the Cartesian cries against Cubist discontinuity have always been raised by those ignorant of analogy and equivocity or equivocity or univocal. Maybe equivocity is not univocal. I don't know that word. It might mean juxtaposing several univocal threads because you're ignorant of analogy and equivocity. Let's look that up. Equivocity? You're following along this, Bert and Roxy, right? You got copies?
Yeah.
Yeah, good.
Yes.
Aren't you loving my exegesis?
Yes.
Yes.
Because you're looking at the
yes.
words I'm played off.
Yeah.
Equivocity. The character of being equivocal. That means being ambivalent in signification. Oh, look up. It says you click on equivocal. Remember, unequivocal means you're certain, right? In no unequivocal terms. It says subject to two or more interpretations and usually used to mislead or confuse. Of uncertain nature or classification. Okay, that's non-univocal. Okay, so I didn't know that word. Equivocal or equivocal? Anybody got a clue how to pronounce this? Maybe it's just equivocal. But how do you make it equivocosity? Equivocity. 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 Equivocity.
Equivocity, yeah.
Say that word to your bus driver next time you see him. I'm not into the univocal. I'm into equivocity. He says, where can I buy some of that? You know, remember at the end of the Future Island song that I play at the end of the music intro, David Letterman yells, where can I get more of that? Where can I get more of that? Equivocity.
I thought he said, I want all you got.
Oh, you're right. You're right. Yeah I'm confused. I'm mixing up my media. Yeah, I want all you got. Doesn't he say, I want more of that or something later? No, probably not. Well, very good, Carolyn. I want more of that. That's like when you know, Finney's Wake is 628 pages. 629, we don't see that page, but it's screaming out, I want more! You know, Joyce has dumped 60 languages on each page. Page 629 wants more. And we got it. Okay, so the Cartesian cries against Cubist discontinuity have always been raised by those ignorant of analogy and equivocity, or equivocity. That's being in this world and not of it. I'm in and I'm out. I'm engaged and detached. So the Catholic idea is, in this world but not of it. But you don't make, I would come on and say, well, you don't value the not of this world more than this world. They're equal. Until you get ascended, then all bets are off. I don't know where you are then. No laughter? That was a joke.
I laughed on my mute button.
Okay, good. Well, this is all old stuff for you. Though you could not talk it. Why don't you come down and explain the next paragraph, Carol?
No, you stop with the, oh, Carol's wonderful, but she's pretty effed up. Well, you just quit that, okay? Yeah. Quit that
now. No.
I'm packing my suitcases, so you better watch out.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, she's leaving again. Another fucking departure. But here's the point. I'm glad that Carol didn't pay attention to me. We wouldn't have got where we got without what this crazy medical thing that she was on. Really? Well, I appreciate you ignoring me for 30 years. No problem. But you've done that. The excuse is over. You now must join Bob Knowledge.
And what am I reading?
You're reading LaRouche's Bible. You're doing
pretty good.
And
what else?
I don't know. What else?
Well, yeah, it's Tarpley stuff.
That's what I meant.
It's Bush. It's,
that's what
yeah,
I
I'm going back over all the Ion notes.
Yeah,
that's
good.
Fun.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm having a good time.
Right. Now, you're doing your work. But, you know, you have to, when you come into the mosh pit on Saturday, everybody's subject to being teased.
True.
All right? That's what we do here.
Mm-hmm. And thank you for not talking too much on Mondays.
Yes, I have to control myself. Though since I brought the FDA in just so that you wouldn't be so high and mighty, so I could get more chance to talk on Mondays, because you haven't got anything to talk about anymore. So, note that.
Yeah, note that.
Note how I use the FDA. Okay, so the next paragraph. But Joyce, while alert to all that Flaubert had achieved for him, was not content with controlling just the larger areas of his discontinuous landscapes. He wanted and got a simultaneous control of the widest perspectives and the most intimate and evanescent moments of apprehension. So he's going for the theory of everything. He was looking at the macro and the micro. And this he was able to achieve by analysis of the labyrinth of cognition, or the drama of the sensory interplay, which Aristotle and Aquinas had revealed to him. It is thus, for example, that he is able to include in the first two pages of the Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man the entire experience of the race, the ground plan of all his unwritten work, and the most individual features of Stephen's expanding awareness. The opening words place the hero in the traditional labyrinth and confront him with a minotaur adapted to his infant years. So the little baby is being fussed over by his parents and relatives. So the opening line of the book is, and this is like its perspective, it's being called Baby Tuku. Once upon a time, I guess it should be a time, I'm not sure if that's a misprint. Once upon a time, and a very good time it was, there was a moo cow. That's the minotaur from the kid's point of view, the baby's point of view. There was a moo cow coming down along the road. And this moo cow that was down along the road met a nice little boy named Bobby Tuku. Yeah, it's me. Named Bobby Tuku. So that's the opening. And then, so then McLuhan says, Stephen Hero is so named because the artist in that work confronts and slays scores of minotaurs. And I'll just say the minotaur is desire and appetite and moves toward the perception of beauty, which is not invested in appetite. The book swarms, you know, the act of perceiving beauty is this definition of involved and detached. That's the definition of the process when you are truly witnessing and engaging beauty. The book swarms with labyrinths of many kinds and levels, you know, many minotaurs from many kinds of labyrinths. Quote, At the so this is a part of the novel. At the door, he had to resign her to others and see her depart with insignificant courtesies. And as he came home alone, he led his mood through mazes of doubts and misgivings. Interesting definition of the labyrinth, mazes of doubts and misgivings. In other words, the thought process, the worry process. Did I make the right move? What will she think of me tomorrow? Following this passage, there is another, then McLuhan says, following this passage, there is another labyrinth, which is both exterior and interior. It presents one of the Dedalus family migrations inside Dublin. So Joyce's father was always failing on his rent and being evicted. So he spent his early, well, I'd say late adolescent, early teen years and teens sneaking out of houses with his mother and father and go find another place because they couldn't pay the rent. So this is so that biographical aspect of Joyce's life is projected into the young Stephen Dedalus in The Portrait of the Artist. On the night, quote, on the night before the day fixed for his legal eviction, he moved his camp by night. So he'd move ahead of time, the father. Before they were evicted, he'd take advantage of no one noticing, so I guess he'd take more stuff or something. The little furniture which remained to them was carried on a float, and Stephen and his brother and his mother and his father carried the ancestral portraits themselves, as the draymen had drunk a good deal more than was good for them. I don't know what that is. That like the furniture men who came along and helped them? I'm not sure what that is. It was a clear night of late summer, fresh and... Yeah, they say the little furniture which remained to them. All right, so the moving guys didn't take everything. So now they're taking that leftover. It was a clear night of late summer, freshened with cold as they walked in a body beside the seawall. Look at that phrase, in a body. There's the group dynamic, the media ecology. The tide was lapping softly by the wall. The tide was laughing, Jesus. The tide was lapping softly by the wall, being at the full, and through the clear air, Stephen heard his father's voice like a muffled flute singing a love song. He made his mother stop to listen, and they both leaned on the heavy picture frames and listened. So I guess his father, who was a good singer, you know, Joyce's actual father, is singing, "Shall carry my heart to thee, shall carry my heart to thee." So they're carrying their heart, their furniture, their identity, their family social mortar. So that could be a clue to what the heart is as Ion defines it. It's your social mortar makeup. So then McLuhan says after that, quote, traditionally there are two kinds of labyrinth, stone and sea. Remember he said rock labyrinth and water labyrinth. So now it's called stone and sea. Joyce uses both constantly. Here, both are fused in the seawall. So remember the tide was lapping softly by the wall. You don't see the word seawall. Oh, no, there it is. They walked in a body beside the seawall. So the sea and the wall, the water and the stone. Both are fused. Here, both are fused in the seawall, in quote, seawall. The family treading the maze between two powers, earth and sea, and carrying the household goods is arrested by the song. Here, both are fused in the seawall. The family treading the maze between two powers, earth and sea, and carrying the household goods is arrested by the song. They're like a separate sentence. The family treading the maze and carrying the household goods, that action is arrested by the song. The moment of, now there's the stopping, the moment of arrest. The moment of arrest is an epiphany, a moment not in time's covenant. And it is by the bringing of complex perceptions to a focus in such moments that the minotaurs of the labyrinths are always overcome. So when you really get the fact that there's no time, therefore no death, that'll give you an arrest, an epiphany, and seeing through your sensory operations. You're not lost in the world of desire or worry or trying to survive death. That's an epiphany when you deeply realize that. And all the puny little labyrinths no longer have their hypnotism over you. So the moment of arrest is an epiphany. a moment not in time's covenant, and it is by the bringing of complex perceptions to a focus in such moments that the minotaurs of the labyrinth are always overcome. So when you listen to Ion and you get an insight, a breakthrough, that's a bringing together of complex perceptions. Because your normal relaxed state of being, which doesn't need an epiphany because it's a realized being already, you get more of those later of non-epiphanies, unless you socially engage and let people give you them. The focus is not focused. It's dispersed. And you're having orgasms on your skin. The moment of arrest is an epiphany, a moment not in time's covenant, and it is by the bringing of complex perceptions to a focus. That's what the little man has to do, step by step, in such moments that the minotaurs of the labyrinths are always overcome. But the technical means of capturing these moments is by landscape, as Wordsworth and others were aware. The Pre-Raphaelites, who come after Wordsworth, the Pre-Raphaelites and then Swinburne, Pater, and the early W.B. Yeats had sought for the means to prolong these moments. But the symbolists discovered that the moment was not an end, but a beginning. That's what I was just saying, right? The little man focused on the moment as an end, but eventually you can relax on it. It was a point from which to begin, so the epiphany, it was a point from which to begin a retracing of the labyrinth of apprehension or sensory interplay or drama of cognition.
I'm slow now. But that's the OA of Ion, the sun and the pyramid.
Yes. Well, that's
the
Alpha, Omega. Yeah,
that's
an epiphany focusing on natural images to make a focused image, a symbol. And that's what univocal culture does. You're going to loosen up on that requirement of these focused epiphanies when you really get more ascended and have more sensory drama happening, which means engaging.
But it's also a way of representing eternity, like all times in one.
Yes. But the ascended person does not have the concept of eternity.
Mm.
There's no concept of time. It's living it. Mm. It wouldn't notice that it could stop, and therefore, I want to make it keep going, so I want eternity. That desire is a little man phenomenon.
All moment is a start and end. So, no time.
You're talking about that part. Oh, the Alpha Omega. Okay. But the symbolist discovered that the moment was not an end but a beginning. Okay. There's your AO. It was a point from which to begin a retracing of the labyrinth of our apprehension in order to find the inevitable art form for that moment. Okay. So he's talking about Gutenberg arts. Like, what is the right way to do a poem or a musical composition or a sculpture or a painting? The art form that coincides with the essence of your epiphany or idea or thought or inspiration. So then Bakunin takes that and makes it huge. The art form for the moment is, should I watch TV? Should I write a book? Should I go to a movie? Should I drive my car? Should I do something else? You get these mass media environments that are the art forms of the 20th century inhabitant. And so if you wanted to orchestrate society into a global art form, which media would be appropriate at which time? And McLuhan suggested we use the computer to gauge the sensory thresholds of the different cultural contents in the global theater. So McLuhan took this sentence. So if you were a media ecologist in 1967, you would try to figure out which medium to emphasize in Venezuela when it was having too many riots caused by radio. You might say, okay, turn off the radio and we'll dump them with newspapers. That'll chill them out. Or dump them with books. That'll make them more visually biased. Less mob rule. So that's what I just said is a metaphor for the artistic creation. It was a point, this epiphany, this focused image, was a point for which to begin a retracing of the labyrinth of apprehension that can be perceived as psychological, sensory, human, chemical body apprehension, in order to find the inevitable art form for that moment. He redid that. He retraced those stages and applied it to media environments. And that's the secret to understanding McLuhan, how he was on a whole different scale than the art critics and art museums and the whole art business, which he puts down in art media, in understanding media, of his day. So if Alyssa is listening to this, Alyssa took art, Roxy took art, art history. They didn't teach you McLuhan, but I'm showing you how you would have a more up-to-date understanding of media environments as art forms, which is what people engage in. That is their art and painting and music. It's like David Lynch in an interview, why did he start making movies? He said he was sitting there as a painter in Pittsburgh or Philadelphia, wherever he was, and he was looking at his paintings, and then he thought, these could move. And he thought movies would make moving paintings. So he started to update his perceptions out of the Gutenberg arts. So that's where we live today, and so the critic who's talking about the aesthetic lives of the citizens and what they're engaged in would have to turn the media environments into media art forms, or what they call in laws of media, media poetics. And that's what he did. And once Alyssa or Roxy, as art students, read this and get it, they say, yeah, this is the breakthrough my professors didn't get to. Right? Do I have
a disagreement? Yeah, because... yes, my understanding of art is completely different.
Now?
Yes. I thought before it was more aesthetic, but now I see it had other functions, like when Ion talks about the paintings owned by Charles V.
Yeah.
At the end of his life, he would look only at the painting called The Cloud of Glory.
Yeah.
And he would just stare for hours at that painting, The Cloud of Glory.
And so what does the citizen, when the citizen is dying today, they're in their old age home and they're watching TV.
Yes, and then the son of Charles V had the Bosco painting that was the portal, the garden of the lights.
Oh yeah, the one they used in War and Peace and Global Village. That's Bosco. What are you trying to say? What is his name? Hieronymus Bosch.
Yes.
We say Bosch. B-O-S-C-H.
Yes. It's this triptico that is actually a portal. And the paintings of Leonardo, they're actually encyclopedias of art and science. Like, he put everything
in. And the astrobody. Let's say what you're pointing out is the astrobody. That's a more advanced astrobody than the theosophists say, but the mystery landscape is what I would call the astrobody, you know, going to other dimensions through portals.
Yes, so
You're saying that's in the Garden of Delights by Bosch?
Yes, Ion told us that the real painting is not in El Prado, because the real one is like a portal. And actually, that painting wasn't on the bed of Fernando IV, the son of Charles V, the one that had the Spear of Longinus.
Yeah. And he had. You're saying he had the original Bosch painting? That was your saying?
Yeah. In his bed, he will look at it also for hours.
It wasn't Charles V who stared at it. It was the son who did it, who stared at it at the end of his life. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Oh, Charles V had the Cloud of Glory.
Yeah.
And the son
had the Garden of Delights
painting, and Ion told us the real one is not in El Prado, because the real one is like a portal. So there are these other functions of art.
Yeah.
Like we can also see in the decoration of Versailles, or in all these castles in La Loire. Art, one can think is only decoration, but everything has a reason, everything has a meaning, and and it's
not just for the chemical body, for the astral body, as a meaning for those realms of experience.
Yes, because in a way, it's a way of, like you said, ascended persons communicating with each other.
Yeah.
That goes beyond just a time period, because they can go
anywhere.
Go back
but
in the past.
This.
Or in the past.
So I got an idea here. Garrett told me that, he said, maybe death is a psychic experience, or when you have a deep psychic experience, like going to another world, it's a kind of death. It would be a death to your addiction to this one plane, this one limited physical world. You wouldn't think within its parameters and think you had a short British life. It would be room for lots of exploration. Yes, that was a joke. You know the famous quote from somebody, we have short, brutish, and some other word, bad lives? Well, LaRouche changed it to short, British, and bad life.
Yes.
And so Nate's the first to notice. I've done that joke for years. No one's ever noticed it. You did,
but
Nate.
The other day you were saying
Nate goes British, or Fred goes British. Bob, you say British. You don't like the British.
the British one, but it's actually maybe the Templars that won the empire. Actually, the ones controlling
the
empire.
The Prussians run the British crown. That's what Ian told us a few years ago. And you look at history, Prussia pops up in the 19th century, symbolized by Bismarck. All of a sudden, they're in charge. So they somehow got the parallel economy going. They got the lead, and while they're in the lead, they acquired or saved or bought the crown jewels and are like the hidden owners of Buckingham Palace, the Prussians.
Yes, but in London, there is a part of the city, the temple, that is like independent of the city. So it's like the Tomar in Portugal.
Right.
They
maybe
have
that's
their,
what the Prussians own. Maybe
like
they
the
own
Vatican.
That. Like the Vatican. So what was that idea I was going to tell you? Did I finish that? What was the
idea? Well, we were talking about the
British
art.
Oh, I was saying the short brutish light. Yeah. So the astral body. Okay, so what was I going to say? So here's the idea. The archetype, since a psychic experience or going through a portal, which would be a pretty devastating, interesting experience for a human, that is the core breakthrough experience in all human life, in all human cultures. It then got proven that that's what life is about, going to many places. Because the technology, second nature technology, created television. So people sit there with an imitation of portaling, and they can't do it naturally, but they can't avoid, that's a prime requirement in being human. So we technologically made the portal for people. So it's a simulation of the archetype of the psychic death experience.
But is it kind of maybe like it's over because it happened like that? It was maybe something that was already happening and it got sort of packaged into TV so that other things could bloom around it?
That would be the way to look at the Android meme as a service. That this technology, as Ion said with that futurist, has a purpose in expanding. And you got to be pretty aware to be able to handle it as you go through the 21st century. I would agree that we didn't have to do chemical body or astral body parallel worlding. We were going to have a chip put in our brain that'll do it to us. And that would probably give a different kind of experience. So it's looking for variety that we're letting this technology unfold.
Yeah,
we want
we're
a different
at it from different angles.
Yeah, we want to have a different experience from old hokey Leonardo da Vinci parallel riff riding. Oh, Jesus. Yeah, we used to do that.
Yes, because like in video games or films or, well, all media, like you said, we are going into parallel worlds all the time.
Yes.
And before they have to open the portals with some type of ritual, or I don't know how they did it. But that's what we see in the Vitruvian Man, this man inside the portal, the portal.
Yeah.
Circle.
And he's got his arms spread out.
Yeah.
You said there's something there, another point. The portaling experience.
The media as a parallel world.
Right.
Charlie.
Right. Something about, oh, yeah. The equivocity means ambivalence, uncertain. This is what McLuhan and Don Thiel say about Joyce and Lewis and themselves, that they're ambivalent to technology. We're not sure, like it's a dangerous route. It could obliterate consciousness. Like the Evereens say, the final Armageddon, and totally fits what we're talking about, the final apocalypse or final Armageddon, is that if we make this technology and then we use it, so we make it, and then we say, okay, we understand that if we press the button and implement it, we will forget everything we ever knew. We'll obliterate ourselves in some new zombie-inducing situation, and the battle of Armageddon will be over whether to press that button or not.
Yes, and it's like sometimes I remember Ion is talking to you, and then he says Hermes and or Lalique, and then in that moment I think about the scarves, this very expensive label of accessories.
What?
Hermes.
Scarves? You just said scarves?
Scarves, like accessories. Hermes. It's a label.
It's a product?
Yeah. He talks about porcelain or Lalique.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
and
yeah,
then,
you're right, yeah. He'd go into Lalique and Linux and stuff. Okay.
Yes,
so,
but one can think he's talking about these things, like objects, but then he was hinting to me, to Hermes Trismegisto, or Lalique is also in Lorraine.
Yeah.
And
so you
there
think
is,
the
like,
objects...
Many,
the objects were symbols for exploring culture.
Yes, but it's something that is done in art. Like, they represent something that you might think is decoration, for example.
Yeah.
But they're actually hints to something else, like when Ion talks to you.
Right.
He might say things that in the moment you don't get, or you might think he's talking about something else, but then... You
it's
understand.
It's very precise.
It can take years.
Yeah, it's very precise.
You already, like in this case, he was telling me to look into Hermetics or into Alsace-Lorraine and all these things.
Yeah, yeah, with those objects.
But I thought he's talking about the crystal or the label of... Some
yeah, oh, China.
Yeah,
China dishes. Okay, so that reminds me that Ion very early started telling Carol and I about certain objects that the elite had. And Carol used to read The Mists of Avalon, all these books in the 80s about warrior women, you know, in medieval or sort of semi-utopian mythical scenes, and they'd always have some magical object, right, Carol? So magical objects are technologies before writing and before literacy, because literacy made us go to another kind of direction of making objects, which led to television. But the power of these technologies, we don't understand how it would be, but they were those kind of technologies that they had.
They were imbued with power. That was the belief of the people.
I think you're on mute.
No.
Okay.
They were imbued with power that represented the belief of the people in the power object.
Well, people were so flexible and good at projecting their beliefs into objects like the Ark of the Covenant.
Right.
that they could imbue, like animism, they can imbue an object with power. That's what we lost, that ability,
yeah.
probably.
Yeah.
Yes,
so that might explain.
These symbols, like the pentacles, like the key of Solomon, all these symbols in the grimoires that people would draw or make talismans.
It's like placebo power.
Yeah.
Creating placebos out of the Ark of the Covenant.
But they were battling with them. One could get the object and then slay your tribal enemies.
Mm.
I think that's what they... I didn't read these books, but I saw the reviews.
Right. Yeah, some of them can be used as defense or offense.
So
everybody was warring, so yeah. But
the first thing I appreciate about Ion is that Ion was an anthropologist, an archaeologist, and he very quickly was pointing out technologies and ways of being that was not within the Western experience that we had registered through literacy or even modern media. And so he would say the Koreans had the blue robe. And he'd try to explain the blue robe, and, you know, it would be odd the way he'd do it. And that was, so he started telling us about ancient technologies that are in mythology and children's tales, but they actually were real. And he would emphasize, like you said, that the humans would put their power in that. They were able to move whatever power they had of making into an object. That's an object as an epiphany. Hey, Roshi, just a minute. Here's the insight. The object becomes the focus, an epiphany. We're talking about an intellectual idea epiphany here for making a poem or a painting. But the object earlier, more sensitive people, could be an epiphany. Is that what you were going to say, Roxy?
No, that my favorite book from Marshall McLuhan is the For the Vanishing Point, because there I got, as he goes through the history of literature, he's showing how one of the effects of media in men is the changes in perception,
yeah.
and how these things reflect in art. And so art is, in a way, also showing all these things you are talking about, the expansions and the effects
right.
in our perception, in our physicality, in our...
Right. When he when he says that every art object Joyce discovered was an extension of the stages of apprehension, that's another way of saying unconsciously that all objects were an expression, an extension, a projection from the cognitive powers of the human. That, you know, that's, you see that switch there, Carol? The extension, art is an extension of a certain proportion of perceptions in the drama of cognition. That's a complicated way of saying you project your powers into the object.
Right. I looked up imbued in my Ion notes, all my notes, and they talked about the Ark, and they said, now this box is being imbued with intention.
The Ark of the Covenant was?
Yeah, the Ark of the Covenant, the box was imbued with intention, and we know that's what moves heaven and earth.
Mm.
That's what he
and
said.
And intention would be a stage or drama of cognition.
Well, you
a direction.
Said at the time, Bob, that's the tactile interplay with source and 3-2-1-ing.
That's my response?
Yeah, and Ayn says, and what the tsunami hits here and not there. And why the tsunami
hits here and not there.
And then you say, and it's also on the mass mind level. Tribal mind is energized somehow, too. Blah, blah, blah.
And that's what I say. What's he say to that?
Absolutely, and you can draw lots of inferences, but don't jump down another rabbit hole. Well, Carolyn will pull it in, put it in the rewrite column, and it will be bad.
That's what I would say.
Stay together here.
Yeah, I would say it and then get carried away with the fact I said it correctly.
And then Ayn goes on. Now, once that imbued power got collected in this box, then it grew as a belief system that there were element that these elements were important because it reminded the people that were not from whence they came. I must have missed a word there.
But that can mean they came from a deluded idea of birth and forgot that they never left and they were coming from an ascended position.
Right.
It might mean that.
Good, yeah. So anyway, I thought that was interesting. It's the intention.
Yeah.
I wonder what they'd say now.
That's the nous poeticos in this article, the agent intellect, the maker, the guided, the focused.
Right.
Yes, and
yeah, but I like how you related it, Carolyn, to placebos and nocebos, because nocebos seem to be very powerful these days.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's placebo? Just you're deciding to make yourself better, so you let something take the credit.
Yeah, being positive about something.
And I had always said the drops were not placebo. See,
right.
That's important. Because the making aspect, electric media makes people remember that consciousness is making and not just matching. That comes back as a value under electric conditions. And that leads to placebo, the popularization of making consciousness is the placebo thing. You have people who have nothing to do with ION and don't care and think it's stupid, and they'll say, well, that's a placebo thing. They all know about placebo. You know, people that it's a very widely spread meme. And McLuhan would say, well, placebo becomes accepted in the popular mind because the electric media enhances the making part of your brain, and people start to, after 40 years of it, realize I'm making a lot of it up, and that's where the concept of placebo fits in there. But Ion comes along and says, as in any environment of that, RNA drops is not a placebo. So it's important to note why we have an anti-environment to the mood of placebo epiphany.
So that makes Ion is more than believing.
Yeah.
Ion.
It is. It's a
Ion.
Part of the being.
Believing it will
a
happen.
Part of our world that we aren't controlling, and it's changing, and you're going to be drowned if you don't tune into it. By taking our product. See, that's a pretty drastic thing. That's why it's currency. It's the one, they say, yeah, I need money to live. No, not anymore. You need our products to live.
Yeah.
To survive. And I know that's totally ridiculous to tell people. But I'm detached, and I enjoy fucking spitting into my fucking garbage man. You know, hey, Mr. Garbage Man, I like the way you take away the garbage, but you're going to have to take my fucking drops, buddy, or you ain't going to fucking be picking up the garbage anymore.
It's the only thing left with value, Bob.
Yeah, the drops. It's value being, it enhances and keeps your right to be forever going. But it has to adapt to the frequency change.
Yeah.
See, the world's being turned upside down. When the inside is outside and the outside goes inside under electric conditions, that's a prediction of what's going to happen to the core of our material being. So if it happens in the media, so media is like art. It predicts the future. So the media environment is telling us a huge flip in being is coming to the deepest levels of matter, and you're not going to be able to stop it, and you're going to have to be subject to it. Especially if you're a little man. I don't know how much, this is the ambivalence of the 418 group, how much do they have to pay attention to ION? How much does their ascension that they already have survive, keep them impervious to this
Is
change?
It changed? Is it changing their state of ascension?
And if you start saying there's no more cycles, that's a pretty radical change because all knowledge is based on cycles. Now, the kind of knowledge that people respect. They're trying to fit Trump into a cycle. You know?
Yep.
This is it. Trump is a fucking raving freak and is scaring people.
Well, you could describe, Bob, that the media is turning itself inside out. That's a,
yeah.
I could.
The media creates Trump. I mean, Trump, as my friend says, he's an effect, not a cause. And he's an effect of the quadriphenic media. And on the practical material level, they say, yeah, we make lots of money from them. So they're enhancing it. But again, it's beyond those categories.
Back April 8th, 2009, ION told me to make a placebo to activate non-physical.
Wow. And that's like,
I think it was a joke.
Yeah, it's a joke, but he's saying that 3 weeks into him. You're not, he knows you ain't even fucking listening.
Yeah.
You don't even believe any of this shit, that I'm Bob's on another rabbit hole of talking to a guy who can't stop talking. McLuhan, Zappa, they never stop talking. LaRouche never stopped talking. I like people who just keep talking. And now I have my own little pet guy that would talk. Like fucking talking pet. What's that? My talking cure. But he, that's 3 weeks, April 8th. I mean,
wow.
That's 18, that's 13 plus 8, that's 21 days, that's 3 weeks. And so he said, why don't you make a placebo to activate the non-physical? But that's what you can understand at that point.
Mm-hmm.
He's not telling you that, wow, actually it's not going to be a placebo.
And maybe that's why he was very adamant about RNA drops is not a placebo, because he had told us that earlier.
No, I don't, because you didn't remember it. But I think it's a very smart statement for where I imagine you were at.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying, let's take something that is flexible, subject to anybody, like chromosome 14 can be used to go in any direction, and use that to make the direction of a non-physical catalyst. Well, that's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Well, heck, but we can't rule out years down the road that it ends up actually being one, that we actually
yeah.
could have done
once
it
you're
all
more ascended,
along,
you're not.
So
once you're not
off.
A little man,
yeah.
life is a placebo. That's what I would
yeah.
say. Experience is a placebo. It's something you pretend you're enjoying.
Here he says, placebo is judged by where they are when you introduce a directional balancing. So it's kind of the pivotal point.
Hey, Carol, let me just say before you go on. Directional balancing. Now, I would stop. What the fuck is, like I was doing with the chromosome 14 in the latest video. What the fuck is conditional response? You
directional
know, we got to figure out what
oh.
way to position your head in the phrase conditional response. It took a long time. He's just talking about, I can't remember, but it wasn't being conditioned. It was like the situation,
the
response to the condition. So, and he wouldn't fucking explain the intonation. That phrase there, what did you just say? Directional intent or...
Placebo is judged by where they are when you introduce a directional balancing.
Okay, directional. Wait, that is good. If visually bias balancing is rigid, trying to be stuck in a point of view,
mm-hmm.
then directional balancing is more multisensory. That's actually a term I was looking for earlier today.
Right, so I would even hazard that placebo can be the pivotal point like chromosome 14, that depending on where your vibrational proximity is to yourself or...
And the what you think is the external.
Mm-hmm.
So say the sentence again with that. That's what directional balancing is?
Placebo is judged by where they are when you introduce a directional balancing.
Who's they? The placebo.
The receiver of the placebo.
Oh, the placebo. Okay, do it again.
Placebo is judged by where they are when you introduce a directional balancing. So you're giving something that allows the person to take it as a positive placebo or a negative nocebo, and they decide. And that, to me, is based on where their vibrational proximity is to non-physical.
And that would be another way to say directional balancing is the dynamic symmetry of tensions among proportions. That's the same meaning.
Mm-hmm.
The balancing would be the symmetry of it. Are you with us, people?
Are you with the crack team of the B and C?
Yeah, Bob and Connie, the crack team?
Yep.
Are you still coming up the mountain? Are you tied to the ropes?
Are you ready to just leap off?
Yes.
No, they're not going that far.
Hey, you guys were talking about, Bob, you were saying that you're now, let's see, what was it, Blick? And
yeah,
Carolyn,
I'm Blick.
And Carolyn suggested
whack.
Whack.
I like blight.
No, that's negative.
No, not necessarily. not
Blick is stupid. To say the different terms these transgendered people are using are so stupid. They're unbeautiful. They're unaesthetic. They're just grunts.
Blight is a plant disease, especially one caused by fungi such as mildews, rust, and smuts.
Yeah, but look at the, I posted the one. Look at, like, the last definition, if it's the same one I have. It mentions Trump.
The definition does? Okay, guys, we only got 45. Oh, you were on mute. Okay. Like, I go over to the other part of the room, so then I have to come over and look. But let's move along here and finish it, but then we're going to have to go back over it. But we only got 45 minutes, so let's carry on. That was good, what we said. So we're talking about this focusing. It was a point from which to begin a retracing of the labyrinth of apprehension in order to find the inevitable art form for that moment. That's much like that sentence you just read. I can put directional balancing and placebo into that sentence that I just read.
Mm-hmm.
So then the quote from Stephen Hero is, in the center of her attitude towards him, he thought he discerned a point of defiant ill will, and he thought he understood the cause of it. He had swept the moment into his memory, the figure and the landscape into his treasure room, and conjuring with all three had brought forth some pages of sorry verse. To inspire him to make a fucking poem, there's the art form for the quiddity of the moment, and it's sorry, Bert, it's not too good. But this drama between a male and a female, a key thing in human experience about what they think of each other, that's what's being worked on here, right? You take anybody, in the center of their attitude towards some other person. So in the center of her attitude towards him, he thought he discerned a point of defiant ill will, and he thought he understood the cause of it. I get that all the time with Carol. At a certain point of fucking expiration, she blocks it, and she will not. The defiant ill will comes up, where I perceive it as she's objecting to fucking even listening to me because she's not going to be surveyed by someone else.
You cannot tell me what to do.
Yeah.
Ever.
I can be told what to do. That's why I'm a good listener, a good dialoguer. I don't mind being told what to do. You little people.
But you don't do it. I tell you what to do all the time. You won't do it.
Yeah, but I could talk it. I could talk
you
about it. I can pretend I'm doing it. You can pretend you're giving in. Yes. He had swept the moment into his memory, the figure and the landscape, into his treasure room. You know, his archetype, his treasures. The figure in the landscape, and conjuring with all three had brought forth some pages of sorry verse. You can see how McLuhan gets all his big ideas, picturesque landscape, stages of apprehension, out of that paragraph. You know what I mean? He adapts it to his what he wants to say. Okay, so then McLuhan takes that, and he says, since the relation of labyrinth and landscape calls for separate treatment, it will serve for now to have pointed out that the conjunction of landscape and labyrinth provided Joyce with that vivisection of the stages of aesthetic apprehension of which he was the only begetter. So he had figured out a way to analyze the stages. As much, therefore, as the ancient Daedalus who made the labyrinth in Crete, much as him, Joyce had the right to name his hero Stephen Daedalus. That's in quotes. And it says in brackets, the French form of the word. Daedalus in the labyrinth. But it's not only the labyrinth of cognition in which Joyce made himself at home, tracing and retracing with delicate precision. The labyrinthine structure of the eye it is that gives such salience in his work to the figure of the Cyclops, the one-eyed thing. Most of all, he was at home in the labyrinth of the inner ear, where he met Perse O'Reilly, who is Perse, son of the real and father of Sir Henry Harcourt Raleigh in Eliot's play, The Cocktail Party. On the labyrinth of the ear, organ of the incarnation. Now, remember I was moving from the picture of the electron, proton, and neutron to words and frequencies as underneath that level of visual matter? That's what he's getting here. On the labyrinth of the ear, organ of the incarnation. That's the organ of your own whatever stage of being you're going to make for yourself. On that, Joyce built those metaphysical analogies which enable him to restore the orchestra of the seven liberal arts to its plenary functions. So the trivium and quadrivium were restored to another level of function that the artist could do and get it out of academia, or the rigid traditions that miss the music of the arts and sciences as analogies, not something to be stuck in. So it says, McLuhan says, Joyce is never less than the artist of the word, capital W. And then he uses the capital W word and says the word makes a market. And that's like biblical if you capitalize the W. So that can also be not only the Christ, but the Antichrist, I think. The word makes the market. Ulysses, the novel, is reared on the labyrinth landscape of the human body as the body politic. So his the novel Ulysses is based on the body politics as extensions of the senses or the stages of apprehension. The idea of media extension of man, media extension of our sensory processes, it's a city level in Ulysses. You know what I mean? City, landscape.
Mm-hmm.
But then he says, and Finnegan's Wake, oh, you know, on another level, Finnegan's Wake whispers throughout with the voice of the river of human blood and immemorial racial consciousness. That's a deeper, more wider level of what the senses are engaged in and extending, or what media are extending. So Ulysses is reared on the labyrinth landscape of the human body as the body politic. But that's just modern industrial democratic society, so to speak. But Finnegan's Wake includes all manifestations of culture and racial existence. And Finnegan's Wake whispers throughout with the voice of the river of human blood. There's where, you know, you get the Ionic. And immemorial. Immemorial means you've forgotten.
Can't be
unless
forgotten.
It's immortalized. I don't know. Immemorial racial consciousness. Joyce was at home in all labyrinths because of his original conquest of the stages of apprehension of the mind in act. Now he brings it back to the word the mind. So the drama of cognition, the stages of apprehension, the sensus communis, the interplay of the senses is, again, just to simplify it, the mind in act. You know, people say the mind runs everything. So Bert and Roxy and Deb were looking at the article as I read it.
Yes.
Okay.
I was thinking how this eclipse, in a way, is symbolic of making the sun disappear. Like this hypnosis we have with these images, these icons, these archetypes.
Of nature.
Like
they have to go.
Like finally, like erase everything you think or you know
or
all
you see. Erase everything you see.
These images that in which we put our power.
Right. Mm-hmm. And look at that video, the panda video. The guy is trying to talk about Trump. And look at the brief glimpses he collages to show what it is. He's trying to get you not to see Trump almost. Or to not be fooled by what you're seeing. In his rapid collage. That's what you're talking about.
That's why I laugh because I remember the thing that they told me. You forgot the Oreo cookie.
Yeah, which is tremendous.
It's a joke because it's like.
Yeah. You had all that stuff you had in there.
We give so much importance to these icons.
Yeah, the famous paintings, Leonardo da Vinci, and you're forgetting the immediate artifact of your time, an Oreo cookie, which is so, I didn't know anything about that. Now we know all about what's in the, it's even written about. Susanna gave us that article. And so I knew precisely on many levels what you left out. It's so appropriate what he said. And we can't say that Roxy made this up. You didn't know anything about the Oreo cookie. Some voice told you this. Some external thing.
It was also made in Manhattan, Bob. It was produced and developed in Manhattan.
Is that where it started, eh? Hmm.
Yes.
In the 19th century?
Yes.
New York City. Okay, so so we're going to redo all this, but just to move it through, the next paragraph. Having suggested that Joyce took up the analysis of this man, I should say this. The stages of apprehension, you guys didn't know that phrase. The drama of cognition, you didn't know that phrase. But those were new phrases invented by the poet McLuhan about what you did know, the mind in act. Right? You might say that you say the mind. You might not add in act, but again, it's the taking the ordinary and making something new out of it. Cliched archetype, but it's a new archetype. Having suggested, so McLuhan now says what he has done in this essay. Having suggested that Joyce, what McLuhan did, having suggested that Joyce took up the analysis of this matter at the very promising stage at which Mallarmé had left it at his death in 1898, I should like to point to what is, so far as I know, the first stage of philosophic awareness concerning the retracing of apprehension as the poetic process, or as the making of an object. It occurs in Thomas Brown's posthumously published lectures on the philosophy of the human mind. Thomas Brown was professor of moral philosophy at Edinburgh until his death in 1820, and it is in lecture 37 where he is considering, quote, the secondary laws of suggestion as they affect genius, that he states the difference between the imagination of genius and the fancy of ordinary minds. The mind of genius, he suggests, works in some sort of reverse direction to ordinary minds. In other words, like Poe discovered, you retrace the stages, you work backwards, and the genius is naturally encountering in society and the different sensory parts of his genius, eye, ear, touch. He thinks in the opposite direction of normal unfolding of perception.
Your work of art was your chart. You were looking back.
Yes. I reversed everything.
Like everybody was trying every time in the cathedrals, in these board games, in the tarot, in the different
artifacts.
Yes, you did your chart to finally do the summary of everything.
Yeah, the final retracing. It was a retracing. That's how I looked at it. I was always retracing. I do that in conversation, right? We're talking. Then I said, how do we get here? So we have to retrace to find out what the magical word moment that got us go off into another direction, right?
Yeah.
I monitor. No, we can't go off track. We must know how we got to where we are. That's sensory analysis. Senses being what you're getting in your different inputs. So this is pretty interesting. So he finds that Thomas Brown defined about this reversal thing as the characteristic of the mind of the genius. And he's considering the secondary laws of suggestion. You know, suggestion is a powerful word. It's what the Evergreens said, all thought is superstition. That implies, you know, self-suggestion. Or the trying to control it out of fear. So
the other day you said in the Pythagoras school they will do a retracing every day.
And what did they retrace?
Their day, because every day is like death and resurrection, like the from the darkness to the light.
Yeah, but are you saying that they would discuss their day at some point in the day?
No, they had to retrace everything they did that day.
To whom did they have to do it to?
To themselves.
Ah. I naturally do that when I go to sleep. Now I go to sleep so fast I don't do it, but I used to. I sort of go over. But that's natural. Everybody does that, right? When you lie down,
yes,
you review the events of the day, right? You sort of.
But also, when people used to die, because we're not dying anymore.
Yeah.
They will do this retracing of all their lives. That's the soul recording.
That was the whole purpose of dying, was to retrace your life, to see all your life flash before you. That's pretty trivial, eh?
That's why we're doing the retracing now, because Ion said it's better to retrace when you are alive. you don't have to die to retrace.
Right. That's right. That's a key point there.
And it was to actually for the judgment that you yourself.
That's
you are
judging.
Your judge.
Yeah. Metanoia is judging yourself. finding out how artistic your life was unfolding, the dynamic symmetry of tension among proportions for beauty were you achieving. It's like humans like to do things well. That's an instinct, and that's probably the God.